This is a fly. This is folly.
With style.
Strange little man.
Welcome to the third episode of Falling with Style. I'm Doug.
I'm Derek.
And this is an ongoing Pixar movie marathon podcast. Each episode is dedicated to exactly one movie in the Pixar Animation Studios canon. Today we're talking about Toy Story 2, Pixar's first and for many years only sequel. As with Toy Story 2 was directed by John Lasseter, developed and written by a whole bunch of folks, and released widely on November 24th, 1999, just a year after A Bug's Life. And prior to this conversation, Doug's seen it a godzillion times. And Derek, I suspect based on our conversation about Toy Story 1, you've seen this one quite a few times as well.
No, actually. I haven't. Okay. I've seen the first one a gazillion times, but the second one... I saw it in theaters actually, but we never owned it on VHS, so I maybe only seen it like a couple of times at most, and so I had very minimal memory of this one. I think this out of all four of them, just because 3 and 4 obviously are more recent, this is the one that I remembered the least.
Makes sense. I will forever be jealous of how many of these movies you got to see in theaters as a child. But before we get into anything else, we have a guest this month. We are joined this month by Vicky from Novel Gaming, a podcast about video games, books, and splashes of pop culture. Hi, Vicky.
Hi, guys. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for joining us. I am so glad to have a guest. You're our first guest, actually.
No pressure.
Yeah, lots of pressure.
But I'm excited to talk to you about this because when we were putting feelers out for guests for these episodes, you and I were talking, Vicky, about like different Pixar movies and whether any sort of resonated with you in any particular way. And I think you were sort of like, maybe not totally sure. But then when we got talking about it, there was something about Toy Story 2 specifically that you said that I was like, wait a sec, I would love to talk more about that because I think it's sort of similar to me. And I think what that is something that really in this movie sort of lays out the path for the rest of the Toy Story franchise. Mm-hmm. And I guess that's the teaser for when we when we start discussing the movie. But I do have a couple production things because the production for this movie was bonkers.
Cool. I'm excited.
Here's your teaser. This movie almost didn't happen for like a million different reasons.
Sure.
None of them good.
I know at least one story from this that I'm excited for you to talk about.
Vicky, since we haven't talked to you before, like where do you fall on the spectrum of Pixar familiarity between Doug reading books in his free time about Pixar and Derek like trying to remember which ones he's seen?
I think I would be probably somewhere in the middle. So I think I have seen most of the Pixar films at some point, once if not multiple, but don't really know any of the backstory or production elements.
Ooh,
so like when you said it almost didn't happen, that was news to me. I did, so like with Toy Story in particular, like we had the Toy Story toys. I think they were from Burger King. I don't know. But we had them all and like multiple sets. So like my siblings and I were into it at the time. And then I think just a general affinity for Pixar and the way they made me feel.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I would say probably somewhere in the middle.
Yeah. We probably should have mentioned this in the first Toy Story movie, but and I won't get super into it, but a really bizarre thing about the Toy Story movies and merchandising is that there was like an official line of toys for Toy Story, but it was actually like a huge challenge for them to convince companies to like buy the rights to produce their toys for a movie literally about toys, which is always like this funny thing to read the Pixar folks talk about because they're like, why was it so hard for us to sell literal toy characters to companies who wanted to make toys? And that'll always be like the funniest thing to me because now it seems like such an obvious no-brainer.
Well, wasn't part of it because like the toys are bigger than regular toys normally are just because of how they had to scale it in the movie. So if they wanted to make them authentic, like I remember the Buzz Lightyears. I did have some Toy Story toys, but I don't remember. I had a Buzz Lightyear, and I know I had a Woody that was not to scale, that he was really tiny. I think I had a regular.
Woody's huge.
Yeah.
And I think I had a regular Buzz Lightyear, but even if I didn't, I know the ones that existed, like when you see it in person, it's like, this toy is gigantic. And like, cause all the toys in the movie, like, I guess they have to scale them up just slightly bigger than like what most toys would be just to make it work, I guess. But like, I imagine that has to be a challenge if they want to make the authentic versions of them, but they also don't have to have them to scale from the movie if they're going to make toys of them. So I don't know.
Yeah, I'm sure that was part of it for a property that didn't exist yet. Like, you know, you would want the toys to be just like the toys on screen. So, yeah, that's such a funny thing to me. I don't remember the Burger King ones, but I bet I could probably find them on eBay.
Yeah, or I'm sure they're in my parents' attic, so I could just set.
Nice.
I'm gonna turn into Weird Al, or not Weird Al, whatever. Al, normal
yeah,
Al.
He's pretty weird.
Yeah.
he's pretty weird. All right. So I mentioned John Lasseter was involved. That's going to be a constant for most of the episodes until, you know, we don't need to get into it. People probably know. If you don't, just search John Lasseter. But the story was, as expected this early on, by him, Pete Docter, Ash Brannon, and Andrew Stanton, major players. And the screenplay for this one was by Andrew Stanton, Rita Shaw, Doug Chamberlain, and Chris Webb. So some new names in there, and some names that I don't think we will see again. So not all members of sort of like the early Pixar brain trust or whatever they called themselves. Here's the thing about Toy Story 2. It was intended to be a direct-to-video sequel. It wasn't supposed to go to theaters. It was given to a secondary team. And this was pretty much a directive from Disney. And that checks out when you consider, like, this was 1999. All the Renaissance movies were getting their, like, direct-to-video sequels with, like, a couple exceptions. And so they basically were just applying their own formula to Toy Story. So right off the bat, this wasn't even supposed to be in theaters, which is wild to think about.
Mm-hmm. Had they already done their like Toy Story shorts that they did a lot of later? Like, did they have any of those between 1 and 2?
No, the only shorts that they had at this point were the ones you would have seen before the film, and then the stuff that they had used to either sell what they were doing to enter into like animation awards or like commercials.
Interesting. Huh. I wonder, I mean, because the direct-to-DVD movie would have had to be, I mean, unfortunately, I feel like it would have had to be lower quality, right? Because every Disney direct-to-DVD movie is always like a lower tier, like no matter how talented they are, I'm sure it's lower budget, probably tighter deadline. So I feel like it would have had to have not looked very good comparatively.
Here's what's funny. You're already sort of like on the right track as to why a direct-to-video sequel wouldn't work for Pixar, especially in these like early formative years. It was too good. They were showing it to Disney, and Disney was like, wait a second, okay. Our direct-to-video sequels aren't doing exactly how we hoped, and this is actually really solid stuff you've got here, so let's like promote this up to a theatrical release maybe. And Pixar was like, oh, that's not really what we intended, but okay, let's do it. And the folks who were actually making this were folks that previously worked on like CD-ROM games for Toy Story. So like, that's big news for them. This, just like the first Toy Story movie, went through tons of different like iterations. The first Pixar movie was troubled with sort of like figuring out story parts and stuff like that. This one kind of went through a lot of the same stuff. But despite that, Disney was still impressed and said like, let's do this. The really horrifying thing about Toy Story 2 is that they nearly lost the entire film, and by entire film, I mean 90% of the film, to an accidental hard drive dump.
What?
At the company.
That's the story that I knew already. I can't. What a nightmare.
Right. So after reworking the story, after getting it on track, after Disney being like, yeah, let's go, they nearly lost the whole thing. Here's the wild thing. The only reason they were able to retrieve this, and they're like, they're totally like open about this. You can go on their website. They have like a cute little animated like mini feature about this, or it might even be on Disney Plus about what happened. they had a technical producer who was working from home because she had just had a baby. And so she had a backup of it so that she could continue to work on it. And they literally like drove to her house, got the computer, drove the entire thing back to the studio and were like, retrieve it now.
Oh my God.
Here's the thing. Even after all that, they still were like, wait a second. I don't think this is going to work. I don't think this is going to work. It's not working quite right. We know you're impressed, Disney, but like, it's not exactly how we want it. So even after that, they were like, I think maybe we got to rework this thing. Disney said no. They were like, no. You have a release date. We gave you a theatrical release date. Get it out in time. And so what would normally be a 2-year production or over 2-year production was completely started over and crammed into 9 months.
Cool.
So the version of Toy Story 2 that we watched, for the most part, obviously like assets were still there, models, like they had a framework, but what we watched was pretty much story-wise and the way it was put together and rendered and animated and all that, pretty much done over 9 months, which is wild. Yeah. As you would expect, it was terrible on the employees. It was horrible. There are horror stories about this time. The one that they always talk about, it's in one of the books I read. I think it's in other places too. Like, it's not a story they hide or anything. It's like a Pixar employee who was tasked with like dropping their kid off at daycare before they went to work, was so tired that they forgot to do that, left their kid in their car, like in the parking lot. Kid was fine. No. Somebody figured it out. They found him. But this is sort of like a story that they tell and that stuck out to them, because as proud as they were to have pulled it off, they're a company who didn't just brag about pulling it off. They said, this was terrible and we can never, ever do this to our employees ever again.
Good.
Exactly. Yeah. I don't know. When we get further down the line, of course, we'll sort of reexamine that. But at this point, they had sort of a spiritual awakening and said, we gotta change our entire culture moving forward. They changed facilities. They sort of came up with a lot of what you would expect Pixar to sort of tout as their values now. Pixar is, I mean, aside from the big John Lasseter thing, a company that has a good reputation as far as how it treats folks and the culture and stuff like that. And a lot of that came from them pushing out this movie that shouldn't have been pushed out as fast as it did. So
just acknowledging that makes them better than like 95% of video game companies. So
yeah.
I know. Well, and the other thing is, like, they didn't fire their whole staff after they put it out, like so many video game companies. You know what I mean? They really have, to a degree, a familial culture, and that's, you know, I think a big part of this. They'll also cite that culture as being part of the reason that folks kind of beat themselves up to get it done, but that's always going to be a conversation of like, you can't really determine how self-determined your employees are when the deadline exists, you know?
Yeah.
The deadline is what the deadline is, so.
And it's interesting hearing all that, because the movie's not a mess. The
no,
movie's great.
No.
Like, I would have never known that.
Right. That's the thing, is like, Toy Story movies are always critically acclaimed to a ridiculous degree. You know, we mentioned on the first episode, it's by a number of measures one of the most critically acclaimed franchises in the history of film, right? Not even just animated films, just like movies in general. And you'd never pick up on any of that from what Toy Story 2 actually ended up being. Mm-hmm. It's incredible.
Yeah. I almost hate saying this because it like feels like it's justifying like the terrible circumstances they're under, which should never happen.
Right.
But I do think, like I said on the first Toy Story episode, that like, the frustrations that they were feeling, like, I think come through in the film in a good way, because there's like this underlying sense of anxiety throughout the whole movie that I think lends to the tension and everything. And I think that that's palpable here too, mm-hmm. in a good way. Like, because these both, I think the first two movies, especially maybe the whole franchise, I don't know, we'll see when we get to it, but at least the first two movies are very much about like existential anxiety of just about your life and what you're doing with it. And, like, I think that really comes through, because these movies have a lot of tension behind them, as fun and fluffy as they are. And I think it comes through because that's what all the creators were feeling at any given time.
Yeah, it's funny. I never really thought of them that way until you mentioned it on our first episode, the anxiety that these movies sort of carry with them. But it's so ever-present.
Yeah.
There are obviously lots and lots of production things. Some of them I'll sprinkle in, but I would love to get to talking about this movie. So I mentioned, I teased that something you said, Vicky, mm-hmm. sort of made me be like, I think we should talk about Toy Story 2. And I don't remember exactly how you said it, what you said. I can't quote you. But I think one thing about Toy Story 2, actually, there's a lot of things about Toy Story 2 that sort of like establish what Toy Story is moving forward and Pixar moving forward and stuff. But one thing I think Toy Story 2 does even better than the first one is establish exactly what the philosophy of Toy Story movies is, to the point that people could probably tell you, like, what the philosophy is regarding toys and kids and like what that relationship is supposed to be. This movie really, I think, drives home the idea that like toys are meant to be played with, and the way that we view toys is more than just like this thing you have. And I remember when we were talking about it, you had alluded to like the Toy Story franchise, and I think Toy Story 2 specifically, sort of like shaping the way that you view toys to some degree, right?
Oh,
yeah. Does that sound familiar, or am I just making that up?
No, you're not making that up. I would say toys, and then just so we had that conversation before I rewatched Toy Story 2, and then rewatching it, I honest to God was thinking, like, I was 11 when I would have seen this. I think this shaped a lot of my mindset.
Ooh.
Yeah. So specifically, like, I don't know if you want me to jump into it right now or not, but like,
go for it.
Okay, so like Jessie's character, I didn't really relate to Jessie as a toy at all, but her story and thinking of a toy or a thing as like a forgotten, unloved thing is something that like is always pervasive in my mind. Like, I don't want a thing or a person or, you know, an animal to feel like unloved or forgotten about. Because, like, I always pick the thing that somebody else isn't going to pick. Like, give me a situation where there are two items and one is, like, broken and damaged. I'm always going to pick that thing up because somebody needs to love it. And I think it had to have come from this movie, or at least, like, a little bit, because I don't know where else I would have gotten that from.
That's amazing you say that, because, like, context, Vicky and I have known each other for about a decade now.
Mm-hmm.
And certain of your faves of just various things, whether they're like video game characters, movie type things or whatever, definitely fit into that mold. And I can think of times when you've been like, oh, but like, just need somebody to love it.
Yeah. And it's not like from a place of wanting to like save all of the things. It's just from like genuinely wanting this thing, person, not person, whatever it is, to feel cared for, inanimate or not, or like make sure like I'm respecting my things because they're mine. And, you know, like, not that they're going to come to life, but in Toy Story they do. So, you know, I could treat it with respect.
Yeah. No, I definitely feel that. I mean, the sort of toys are meant to be played with, and toys are meant to be loved and not simply displayed and that sort of thing. You know, it's a very particular philosophy of this series. And not everybody necessarily would agree with that in real life, but it definitely pervaded my thinking as well. Is pervaded a word?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay. I kind of worked backwards from pervasive. There have been times like through my 20s and even into my 30s where like I'll get a toy that I get because it's like sort of a collectible thing or something that I just like am nostalgic for. And I have the thought from specifically Toy Story 2 and this storyline of like, do I want to keep this in the box or not? Mm. And whether I actually choose to keep it in the box or not, regardless of what the outcome is, I always come back to the thought of like, but toys are meant to be played with. And I think of how sad toys would be to just sit in their packaging.
Yeah.
And, fully agree. You know, I don't necessarily think it has to be that way for a lot of people. I think this movie has a very particular perspective on collectors that is not complimentary at all.
Mm-mm.
Nope. No.
So that's something that I'm sure people could pick apart. But for me as a kid and into adulthood, I can't shake that. And I don't think I ever quite will.
Do you all have like any toys that you still have to this day that like you'll just never get rid of?
Oh my gosh, yes. I have.
Yeah, same.
Yeah, I've got my two, well, this is funny and relevant. So I have like one stuffed animal that I had from like when I was a baby that I still have. It's here at my house, even though I've like moved far away from my parents. And I keep it in the closet. And then a second that was, you know, kind of in the family of that stuffed animal style that I got at a thrift store and couldn't put it down because it, you know, was related to Moose Cowie. So they need to be together. So they will never, ever go anywhere.
I love it.
Yeah.
There are a lot of things that are still at my parents' house that I've been meaning to go back and look at, but I take for granted the fact that they don't get rid of a lot of things.
Mm. Yeah.
But I would be heartbroken if they did. Yeah. So I've been meaning to go back and just make sure I collect those things, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The one that stands out to me for sure is this. It's also a stuffed animal, but it's like a stuffed dog, which is so funny to me because I'm like not very much of a dog person, but it's like this stuffed dog that it's probably the earliest sort of like toy I feel like I remember being attached to. And I know it's still there and I know where it is. I just need to go grab it just to save it from any sort of unfortunate outcome.
Yeah, I'm like, my parents are the same way too. Like, they have a big basement that's just full of boxes of everyone's mm-hmm. memories. And it's always like, yeah, we should really go through all this stuff. And then nobody ever does. They just keep it together. I've had to try to like shed my kind of hoarder-esque tendencies as I've moved to smaller places. But yeah, I have. It's actually, this wasn't connected to us doing Toy Story, but like pretty recently I dug up one of like my toys that like I'll have out and then occasionally it'll like just go in my nightstand or something and then occasionally I'll have it out for a while. But right in front of me, I have my my old worn Transmetal 2 Cheetor from Beast Wars. Ooh. That's missing his gun and missing his tail. But it's one of those things that like I connected to for what just because of the timing when I got it, like it basically became like my therapy animal. Like that was the thing that I remember I was going through a lot of bullying in school when I got it. And so that was the thing that I would just like talk to and like tell my deepest secrets and feelings to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And like actually treated it like it was like my friend and alive and everything. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's like, I don't need that now, but it's still like, I would never want to part with him because there's like I have like a special connection to him, and in the same way that like even if I don't fully consciously intellectually believe that he is a living creature with like thoughts and stuff, I still like feel like that. And it's sort of like, I don't want you to feel like I've forgotten you, so I'm gonna put you at my computer for a while to remind you that we're still friends.
Yeah,
that was so well explained. I mean, I feel very similarly with mine, and I couldn't really put words to it, but that's exactly it.
Yeah, it's so funny our capacity to kind of personalize things and humanize things like that. And I think the Toy Story movies, and I think this one even more so than the first one, just speaks to that so effectively.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, we're all about the same age, and we grew up with these movies almost exactly in real time, at least the first three, right? Like, they sort of followed our age, just they decided to keep Andy aging in real time for the most part. I hope, though, that these movies sort of, like, foster that in kids who either don't already have those sort of ideas being given to them or who have sort of like a spark of that or an ember of that, you know, because it's like listening to those types of stories, ones where you find comfort in toys and learn to care for things and find empathy even for things that don't necessarily have feelings. I think that stuff is so important. And I hope that these movies do that for kids. Lord knows a lot of adults could use it too, but hopefully if it's fostered in kids earlier, then those things carry into adulthood, kind of like it sounds like they have for all three of us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely.
So the story of this one, it's kind of funny. I think a long time ago, I might have distilled this in like an unfair way. You know, on the surface, Toy Story 2 is, quote, just a role reversal. I think it's a lot more than that, but I do think at its core, there's a lot of role reversal involved in the fact that, like, the first Toy Story is about Buzz kind of coming to an existential awakening by realizing he's a toy, and then this one flips that, and Woody sort of loses his sort of awareness by learning he's a collectible. And it's funny because like that's kind of what I used to distill it to, and there's just, I think there's a lot more to it than that, but that's probably the first thing I would sort of note about this movie and its relationship to the first.
Yeah, that's the most sequel-y thing about it, I feel like, because that's where most of the references are too. But I was really surprised going back to it, like having just rewatched Toy Story and then A Bug's Life, and those being the only two Pixar movies I've watched recently, it's funny seeing that like progression, because this compared to the first Toy Story, in terms of narrative, it's wild how simple the first Toy Story is and how complex and how many subplots and like mini character arcs this movie has. It's it makes a lot more sense now going from A Bug's Life to this movie because the sort of like multi-story line structure like fits both of those movies, and both are such a departure from the first Toy Story. It's so interesting.
For being the third movie in their canon and for starting, I know the movie drastically changed over its production history, but for being the third movie in the canon and starting as a direct-to-video sequel, this movie is such a G-dang flex. Like, yeah. The way it starts, flex. The way it ends, flex. Some of the things that they do animation-wise, flex. Looking at it really critically and through the lens of, you know, the historical canon, like we're trying to do, and like look at the sort of development and stuff. Man, there are certain things about this movie that I was like, they really were showing up and showing off. Like even just the opening sequence, it really opens with a look what we can do type of sequence with like the Buzz Lightyear video game fake out thing. Yeah. Like, oh my gosh, the third one will do that too. So I can't wait to talk about how the third one opens. But this one, just like, my God.
I totally forgot that's how this movie opened too. Yeah. So I was like, good, there's so much happening right now.
I mean, they have so many more sets on this movie than they do in the first one. The first one had like a handful or so. And I remember us even talking about this, like how few sets they actually utilize in that first movie. This one has 18, which, you know, still isn't a ton for a modern animated movie, but at the time was like pretty big considering the sets on the first two.
And they're all like outside and in big cities and there's like cars moving all around. Like even the first one, the few that they have are like really enclosed spaces or like an empty street at night or something. Like that, there's so much happening in this movie at any given time. It's wild.
Yeah, Vicky, you said that, you know, we had talked about it and then you rewatched it. Were there particular like scenes or sequences that you had totally like forgotten about or that surprised you kind of all over again?
Yeah, so it's not setting, but just like the physical humor that was used in this movie like blew my mind. I mean, even like, again, opening sequence and like Woody, you know, riding the dog and like how he's bouncing around and stuff. And I didn't remember any of those jokes or like how they use the actual characters to convey humor. So there's a lot of like story that I did not remember at all. Mm-hmm. So hearing you all talk about Toy Story 1 and then just watching Toy Story 2, it was really kind of weird juxtaposition. But I do, so without having seen Toy Story 1 in the past 3 years or so, I feel like I watched it when Toy Story 4 came out. Like we watched them all in order. So it's been a while. But having not seen that or A Bug's Life recently, I do think this movie ages really well. Yeah. It feel like with all of the settings, even if the technology isn't doing what it could do, you know, in 2020, like it still felt like very, very fresh and it didn't feel dated to me by any means.
Yeah, I fully agree with that. I was one of the things that I think sticks out to me as such a good point of comparison is looking at Buster versus Sid's like mutant freak dog in the first movie. What's his name? Scud, right? Just those two things alone, like the way that they do the two different dogs and how big of a step up Buster is wild. And how many years was it? Like 3 or 4 years after the first one?
95 to 99, yeah.
Yeah, that's wild to me that it advanced that much.
Yep. Still largely avoiding human figures and faces, but we'll get there eventually. that's a big moment in Pixar's history and one of their sort of goals, I think, that they ended up meeting quite well. But yeah, Buster, my gosh, way, way better. Other things too, like even just, I mean, their textures and their sort of surfaces still are probably, I think, the stuff that ages the worst in a movie that ages incredibly well.
Yeah.
But that's in line with kind of what we were noting the first time around, which is like the stuff you're not meant to look at is going to be the stuff that doesn't look amazing because at this point, why focus on it, right? Now, if you watch a Pixar movie, like everything looks hyper-realistic in the background. Not so much yet. I will say, though, the dust on the shelf, all those individual, like literally millions of dust particles, that's something I read about in a magazine article, I think before the movie came out, and was, it blew my mind as a kid. Because like you said, Vicky, we were like 11 years old when this movie came out. Mm-hmm. And I remember reading that and just being like, 2 million dust particles? Like, what do you even do with that? You know what I mean? Like, and it looks good, you know? It's uh-huh. it's such a funny detail for them to focus on when you consider, like, you know, the pebbles in the space scene don't look incredible. But I think in line with our theory about the things you're supposed to pay attention to, the fact that he's on the shelf in the first place is so significant. Like, mm-hmm. they spend an incredible amount of time and energy making it feel like that's where he is.
Yeah. Yeah. That looks, the shelf looks really good.
It's such a weird thing to like praise the shelf, but it's so
but it's
true.
So, but it is, it's such an important moment because that sort uh-huh. of jumpstarts the entire, like Woody's entire arc in the movie. So it,
oh, yeah.
I think it makes sense. Yeah. They're focusing on the stuff that they want you to pay attention to make it look really good.
Mm-hmm.
On the same lines of like talking about dirt, I noticed that there's like grime on the toys
oh, yeah.
in this movie, which, you know, I like you see Woody get clean and you have like old Buzz compared to the like newer Buzz.
Oh so, my like, gosh. The shot of him getting his eyeball cleaned.
Yes.
Normally that would be horrifying, but he's a toy. So yeah. just like looking at it and being like, what is he about to do? And then seeing the improvement on the shine, you're like, whoa,
mm-hmm. yeah,
that's not real.
And it's so it really is, and it's so subtle and like almost even kind of unnecessary to have them like kind of any of them dirtied up in other scenes, but mm-hmm. like when you notice it, it's so effective to like remember that like, oh yeah, these are used toys that are getting older. That's the point of the story.
Yeah.
Yeah, and when at the end, I did notice that this time around, and at the end, when Woody goes back with the group and he's like all dirty again, I made a comment. I was like, oh, he looks all grubby and gross. But well-loved, very well-loved. So it's yeah. a trade-off, you know?
Well, that's sort of yeah. the thing, right? Like they really, I mean, they reinforce a lot of what they did in the first movie, but they really drive home a lot of these points that become super important to this franchise, and not even necessarily knowing they would make more, because that's mm-hmm. not really how Pixar operates. But you see it continued, right? Toys age. We'll see in future movies that like certain toys just won't be in the cast anymore, mm-hmm. kind of like they thought happened to Wheezy, right?
Yeah.
The philosophy, the aging, the dirt, the grime, the fact that they, as they make them more realistically toys, they also somehow become more lifelike at the same time. Like, it's just, it's oh, it's so cool. It's so cool.
It really is. It is so interesting, too, because one of the things that I know, I remember when we were talking about the first movie, is that knowing where the series goes, like, and how philosophical it gets and how much is, like, metaphor for certain experiences in real life, and you don't really get that in the first movie. And this one, you get that a lot. Like, it's so,
oh, yeah.
it's so applicable to, like, so many instances of life and, like, mortality in general. Mm-hmm. And I feel like it comes out, it, like, it makes perfect sense, but I have to imagine if you're seeing this for the first time, not knowing where the series goes afterwards, like it comes out of nowhere, essentially, where it's just like, oh, my God, they're really addressing this whole growing up situation here. This is frightening.
I love that you bring that up because I only wrote down one quote from this whole movie because I wanted to make sure that I included it.
Yeah,
it's towards the end of the movie, which is fine. We don't go in order here. Stinky Pete. Who I guess we will after this, let's talk about all the characters they introduce. But
oh, yeah.
Stinky Pete says to Woody and the other toys, children destroy toys. You'll all be ruined, forgotten, spending eternity in a landfill. That's fucking foreshadowing that they Ooh. Didn't even mean to do.
Yep.
Because that's the ultimate spoiler alert, everybody. If you haven't seen Toy Story 3, if you are just watching Pixar movies for the first time because you listen to us, jump ahead 15 seconds. That's literally what their fate almost is in Toy Story 3.
Shit.
So the fact that that line is in there, you know, a decade before they got to that point, I love that. I love that so much. So cool.
Oh, man. Wild stuff.
They're good at this.
Yep.
So, okay, they do introduce a bunch of characters in this. Any favorites right off the bat, Derek, as far as new characters go?
Well, not new characters. Rex is still my favorite, even more so after this movie, because he's firing on all cylinders in this movie.
Oh, yeah.
He rules. New characters, there wasn't one that, like, really spoke to me. Like, I mean, Jesse is awesome. Like, Jesse rules.
Yes.
Like, that's fine. But I can't say that she, like, connected with me on a way, like, in a really significant way.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's more speaks to how well Jesse's story is handled.
Oh, my gosh.
Because the fact that, like, I can't say that, like, oh, she's my favorite character ever. But it's just so good and engaging that, like, I still love her as a character.
Yeah.
But I don't, yeah, I don't have one that I really deeply connected with in a way that I did with some of them in the first movie.
Vicky, you talked about Jesse early on in this mm-hmm. conversation. I think that this movie kind of broadcast the type of Pixar we would eventually come to know before we realized it was coming, because I think that Jesse scene and that frickin' Sarah McLachlan song, I think that's the first time Pixar, like, broke everyone's heart simultaneously all at once.
Mm-hmm.
Because where is that moment in the first two movies? Like, yeah. There are sad moments, there are happy moments, there are, like, existential things. Like, they're not totally cotton candy and popcorn, but, like, dear Lord, yeah. Pixar, like, you went in.
Well, and they didn't, I mean, it's not misplaced by any means, but, like, that segment, like, is such a shift in tone from the mm-hmm. rest of it. Like, there's some doom and gloom and identity things going on, but, like, that scene in isolation, like, really, really, I mean, whew. And so when we had talked about Toy Story 2, Doug,
yeah,
that was, like, my one thing that I could remember about the movie is, like, oh, mm-hmm. and in my head it was, like, yeah, that song, When Somebody Loved Me, and I referred to it in my head as, like, a Sarah McLachlan-like song, and then rewatching mm-hmm. it, I was, like, they are you, like, it really was Sarah, like, of course, like, no one
they
else
knew
could
what
do
they
it.
Were doing.
Yeah, oh, my God, yeah. For I think that is the yeah. first, like, gut punch. Thank you, Pixar.
I think, you know, honestly, I think if you asked most people just on the street, if you just did, like, a random poll and asked them to name a few things they remember from Toy Story 2, I think that would be on, like, nearly, if not literally, everybody's list mm-hmm. is that moment, like the Jesse moment.
Mm-hmm.
That was definitely a thing that I remembered vividly.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think you're right, Derek. I think she's just done so well that it's hard not to like her. I think the fact that Joan Cusack is also, yeah. I think, just, like, an inherently charismatic and sort of like has such a gravitational pull, at least for me. I hope that's the case for everybody else.
I think so. She's such an inspired choice, because I don't think if you were to try to get me to cast Jesse, I don't know if Joan Cusack would have ever made my list for it. I don't know what it is about her. I don't know how they came up with her for the role, but it's a brilliant move.
This is not a dig at Joan Cusack, because I adore Joan Cusack. But I think if you were to describe the character of Jesse, it's this energetic, youthful, sort of, like, endless pool of energy.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that's how anyone would describe Joan Cusack.
No.
You know what I mean? But she kills it.
Yeah. Like, I feel like the other iconic roles she has are, like, the, like, bougie villain in Addams Family, and then, like, I don't know, School of Rock or something, where she's, like, the uptight principal lady or whatever. Like, that's, yeah, like, this is not the type of role that you know her for, mm-hmm. but she's so good.
Yeah. There's normally an awkwardness to what she's delivering. Mm-hmm. Like,
yeah.
Something. And yeah, this has none of it. She's so good. Oh, so good. Yeah, I mean, Jesse's probably, I guess there aren't a ton of new characters introduced in this, but there are ones that'll continue on, right? Like,
yeah.
Like Jesse, like Bullseye. We'll mention Barbie a bit more in just a sec, but there are a number of new, technically Mrs. Potato Head too, because she was introduced at the end of last movie.
She's awesome too. I forgot yeah. She was a new one in this one. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Well, lots of female characters. They realize Bo Peep, you know, was carrying the entire movie as far as female representation goes. And she's, what, literally stuck to a lamp most of the time? So adding a few female characters, not a bad move.
Yeah. I mean, it's still, like, a wife and Barbie. Yeah. And, like, at least, like, Jesse is, like, a good, well-fleshed-out character.
Mm-hmm. Totally, totally. I think that's it, right? Like, so at the point at which you realize, like, oh, maybe there's even, like, a romantic thing with Jesse, like, it doesn't detract from the fact that you've had an entire movie
to
learn exactly how freaking cool she is and her whole story. I mean, she's so fleshed out by that point that you're like, well, that's just, you know, now she's a fully realized character. Why not give her even more?
I'm glad they hold it until the very, very end.
Oh, for real.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, and even through the series, it's never, like, massive, you know, it's a thing, but it's never massive. So I think she's such a great character, but she's my favorite of the new ones. I like Stinky Pete kind of, but you know, I only recently learned that Kelsey Grammer is not a person that I personally like very much. This is a new realization for me. Really a role that Pixar's on here, casting their villains with eventually revealed real life unsavory characters.
I didn't know.
He's not Kevin Spacey bad.
Okay. Yeah.
And then, like, who else do we get? We get Al.
Dennis Nedry.
Ay, ay, ay. You mentioned Barbie. Best thing about Barbie. Well, Barbie's great.
Sure.
One of the best scripted bloopers.
Yes.
Of all time. It's not even technically a blooper, but just amazing. I still quote that all the time, and I get so sad when nobody knows what I'm talking about. The tour guide Barbie, are they gone now moment.
That's so good. Oh my God. So I love good. That they ended on that. It's so, so funny.
It's incredible. Are they gone? Is everybody gone? Can I stop smiling? Oh, it's amazing. That's Jodie Benson. That's Ariel from The Little Mermaid.
Oh,
you better believe I knew that even as a child.
That's impressive. I would not have identified that as a child.
Oh, I mean, well, that's the thing. If I saw that name in the credits, I knew that. I think my parents true. Made sure I knew that too. Yeah, that's a great choice because she so rules good. And that is such a, it's just so clever.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So great. what else do we want to get to? What other things? I mean, there's so much in this movie. We could kind of go anywhere.
I think there is a conversation to be had about Al and many things about him because he's a interesting, complicated character that I don't and I don't know if he ages very I don't think he ages very well. I think the thing that really struck me about it is that like he's a bad guy who gets his comeuppance on paper, and I'm glad that, like, the first thing we see him do is, like, steal a children's toy. So, like, that doesn't set him up to be a good guy or anything. But, like, really, the only bad things that he does in the movie is, like, that, which sucks, and, like, be mean to service workers, which also sucks. But, like, I feel like they needed something else to make him worse because for the middle chunk of the movie, I feel like the thing that we're supposed to, like, dislike him as a villain for is just, like, being a gross fat man baby kind of thing, which I don't like. Like, I feel like that's where the movie lands, and I'm not a fan of that.
I do think, I think that is, it's certainly a conversation. I think one thing they could have done more was to really highlight that he's also a dishonest guy. I mean, he's selling this toy, and this is, I think this is the type of thing that would go over a lot of kids' heads, so it's not, I don't think it really computes with what they're supposed to pull out of why he's bad or gross. He's a dishonest guy. I mean, he's selling this toy that's been played with for years and years and years as a brand new collectible. I mean, he even brings in like a shady guy to like fix it and stuff, but that's all pretty subtle.
Yeah.
And I think like as a kid, I didn't pick up on that. I just was like, oh, Woody's getting fixed. Cool. Look how shiny he is. But the other thing that I think complicates it, I don't think it complicates the ultimate takeaway, right? The takeaway is what the takeaway is because you have to look behind the scenes to get the additional meat out of this. They basically cast Wayne Knight to play Wayne Knight. You know what I mean?
Right.
And so many of Wayne Knight's characters, for better or for worse, I don't know how much of it he's a part of, but so many of Wayne Knight's characters are just that. I mean, you look at Newman, you look at him on Jurassic Park. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's like pretty much just playing himself almost down to like the body type and almost the look of his face. Like you could tweak a few things and it's just Wayne Knight, you know, like change his nose, give him some hair, bada bing, you know. So it's like it's frustrating because it's like I kind of get how Al came to be, especially if Wayne Knight was cast first, but I don't know, I'm not sure what the timeline was on that, and it still doesn't change the fact that he reads a particular way to the vast majority of people who are never going to look into it.
Yeah. And you know, he's also, it's also like that sort of like kind of tired archetype of like he's a toy collector, so you know he's obviously like a total loser,
a little eccentric,
looks like your typical nerd.
That's the big thing for me. Like we know a ton of collectors, like adult collectors, mm-hmm. of all sorts of things, and this is a very unkind representation given it's the only representation in the whole movie. We don't get to see the person buying it. We don't, you know, the sort of Jerry recycled character who fixes Woody doesn't really have a personality.
Mm-mm.
Right.
So, I mean, we don't get any other characterization of this adult toy collector, and he's gross and he's a villain, and it's really unsavory.
And it's like, I understand how a toy collector would play to toys, like from their perspective,
right.
All toy collectors are going to be kind of villainous. I mean, you know, unless you want to be in a museum, like they're the idea of like just kind of being stolen or bought just to be put in a box or in storage or on display. Like, I can see why that would be bad, but they want to sell that to the audience too, not just having the toys perspective. So they have to make him a villain, you know? And he has his funny moments and stuff, but they even have like, oh no, he burped and it's gross. Oh, he spilled his cheese puffs all over the place. It's just like, okay.
It's a lot altogether.
Yeah. And coupled with the fact that the other villain of the movie in Stinky Pete, like he's also a hefty guy too.
Yep.
That's a good point. I've never really connected those dots. That's not great.
Yeah. And I don't think there was like malice behind it or anything. It's just like, you know, societal norms at play, right? So.
Well, and like, you know, like John Lasseter is like the same. Yeah, he's a big guy too.
Yeah.
So it's like weird because it's like, that doesn't exclude him from building the same characters that society does, but there is an unfortunate irony in the fact that he's, you know, developing this movie and directing this movie, and all the villains are just like big, chubby, gross, stinky dudes.
Yep. I'm also aware of the blooper that was cut because it was that involves Stinky Pete. That's like too close to what Lasseter actually did in real life too.
Oh, that's right. Oh my gosh. I forgot about that until you mentioned it.
Cause that's not on Disney Plus.
Vicky, did you watch this on Disney Plus?
Yeah, I did. I don't know what this is.
Oh gosh. There's a blooper where Stinky Pete basically does like a casting couch joke. And it's gross.
It's like, this is one of the things that I do remember from seeing it as a kid in theaters. Like, yeah, it's like he's with like a couple of Barbies and he's kind of hanging out like with a couple of hot women. He's like, you know, I can get you a part in Toy Story 3.
Oh, boy. You know what? There's certainly a conversation to be had about like keeping certain content in or out of movies, but considering it's a blooper and it was gross in the first place, I'm okay with that one not being on Disney Plus.
Yeah.
I'm okay with that.
I only bring that up because we were just talking about the weird parallels between like who Lasseter is and who kind of like the villains of the movie are, and I have to wonder if there's some interesting self-hatred stuff going on there, or like self-awareness or reflection that, you know, is just being projected onto these movies, unfortunately.
Yeah, I don't know. Oh boy. Oh boy.
not to get too dark here, but I mean, that's the reality.
I think it's the reality, even if it weren't getting real life, the darkness is a reality, I think, of a number of Pixar movies. Like it's in there. It's sort of baked in, but oh boy.
You know, it was a passing moment and not a huge thing, but I really didn't even like the jokes that like Potato Head and Ham were making when Tour Guide Barbie jumped in the car, you know, like made a pass and I was like, really? Like, this didn't need that.
I remember I'm a Married Spud from the commercials.
Yeah.
Like that was in the trailer for sure. Or at least the commercials for the VHS.
Yeah.
Probably both.
Yeah. At least like Barbie just like does not even acknowledge any of that happening. So like it's not like she's like, ooh, hoo, hoo, hoo. Like she's not, like it's all on them essentially.
Very
so,
true.
Yep. Yeah. It's interesting the way that Barbie enters this movie and is portrayed in this movie, given what we kind of know almost happened in the first one, as far as like, you know, Joss Whedon fought for her inclusion. It didn't actually happen. She was supposed to ride in on her Corvette. In this one, she's driving in on her car. And one of the concerns was like, you know, she's not really supposed to have a character. I think that kind of shows in this. Like the Barbies they encounter don't fully have like a character within the movie. Mm-hmm. And the sequence in which they apply is so short that they never really run the risk of it. And I wonder how much of that went into convincing Mattel, like, I think we figured it out. Like,
yeah,
we're not jeopardizing your character, which obviously we'll see, you know, wasn't an issue later on, but
Yeah.
At this point, I'm sure only 4 years later, they were still having the same concerns.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because when you asked me about if I had any characters that I really liked from this that were new, I almost said Barbie, but then I'm like, no, I like Barbie in the third movie.
Yep.
And I think I might, like, when we revisit that, she'll probably be who I say.
Mm-hmm.
But she's not really anything in this movie. She's just kind of fun, a fun joke.
Yeah. Well, and while Jodie Benson voices this Barbie, it's not the same Barbie. I mean, it makes sense that she would voice all the Barbies. in the same way that, like, Tim Allen voices all the Buzz Lightyears. But, yeah, it's a different Barbie, so it's nice, you know, it's nice to be like, well, it's a different Barbie. It's okay.
Yeah.
What did you all think of the Buzz Lightyear stuff?
I loved it.
I think it's fun.
Oh, my gosh. And because I forgot that happened, and I was like, oh, my God, like, this is hilarious. And, again, with, like, that physical humor, so, like, even seeing real Buzz's face, like, reacting like, oh, my God, like, did I do this? And I was like, ha-ha, tasty your own medicine. It was just so funny.
Oh, another fat joke, by the way, since we're tracking that stuff.
Yep.
He makes a fat joke about himself.
Oh, he does?
But other than that, yeah, I like the Buzz Lightyear stuff. I think it's fun. I think this movie starts to, with hindsight, kind of shows us what their solution for continuing to use Buzz Lightyear is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because once he sort of has a realization about, oh, I'm a toy, what do you do with him, right? He's the one character in the first movie that goes through, like, a dramatic change of personality and character. So, where do you go from there? Well, you introduce another Buzz Lightyear who doesn't know he's a toy, have him interact with the Buzz that does know he's a toy, .. We'll move on to the third one eventually. And you start to see a pattern of, like, how they make Buzz work over and over again, which I think addresses something you and I have talked about, Derek.
Yeah, that's the thing is, when I was getting to that, I struggled to remember if the, like, Buzz getting, like, reset or replaced or whatever was in this movie or the third movie. And then I remember, like, oh, no, it's basically in both movies. They just do it again in the third one in a different way. And then come the fourth one, they just don't know what to do with him at all. So, like, it is something that's kind of unfortunate about it. And it's, like, it's kind of funny because my memory of the Toy Story movies was that Buzz and Woody are the main characters, when I think the reality is that, like, Woody is always the main character. These movies are fundamentally always about Woody. Buzz just happened to be, like, a major player in Woody's story in the first one, and he's really kind of incidental in the rest of the movies and doesn't really need to be there and is only there just because he exists in the world and is just, like, the secondary character. But I don't know if they ever, again, we're going to revisit the third and fourth one. Maybe I'll change my mind, but I don't feel like they ever really get a handle on, like, Buzz's place in these movies ever again, because he's too important to be just a supporting, like, joke character, like, you know, like Mr. Potato Head or Rex or Ham are. But he's, like, never has enough of a fleshed out arc after the first movie to, like, feel like he actually should be part of, like, the main trifecta of characters, you know. But that said, all of that said, the stuff in this movie is still really fun and funny, and I wouldn't take it out. Like,
totally.
I think it rules, so.
I was going to say, like, here's my favorite thing about the Buzz stuff in this movie is that along with Woody's history as a toy, expanding the universe of toys in a way, they do the same thing with Buzz to a degree by introducing more Buzz Lightyears, introducing Emperor Zurg, having the video game, doing another Star Wars reference. And I like that this movie builds out not necessarily the real universe, although I guess it does with Woody, but there's, like, a parallel in that with Buzz where it's like we also build out Buzz's sort of not real universe, which, of course, we see end up in, like, the traditionally animated cartoon Buzz Lightyear show, which we won't necessarily talk about. But I do like that. I like that because he had so much of a, like, stubborn realization of who he was prior to being a toy, they just expand on that more, right? Like, they don't drop that at all. They, like, quadruple down on the lore of Buzz Lightyear. It's great. And
everyone involved in his entire toy line, like, for some weird, like, cosmic reason, everyone in the Buzz Lightyear toy line, like, is like him, where they don't realize they're a toy. That's really fun.
Yeah, I don't know what it is. And I guess we technically don't really see other new toys as they're, like, born into a child's, like, universe. But yeah, we frequently see it with the Buzz line.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because all the Zurg stuff is really fun. I love that. And I love that it ends with them just like Zergs. They do the Star Wars reference, which like at this point I'm just like, okay, whatever. But then I love how it ends with like, oh no, he's playing catch with his son. Uh-huh. And Buzz is like, yippee. Like, all right, cool. That's fine.
Yeah. Derek and I are very pro Zerg. This is a different podcast, but we did a After Dark commentary on Walloping Web Snappers about the Buzz Lightyear cartoon, where we realized that Zurg is actually, you know, a gay icon, and should not be forgotten about or underestimated in his significance in history.
In the cartoon, he is actually voiced by Wayne Knight.
Oh, yes. What?
And he plays them like flamboyant gay daddy, and it rules.
It's so over the top.
That's awesome.
I love it. I don't know if it's on Disney Plus yet, but keep your eyes peeled because it's worth a watch for sure. If only for Zurg, but for plenty of reasons.
Yeah.
Can we talk about the airport scene?
Oh, yeah.
You know, when we talked about A Bug's Life, we talked about the flight through the branches and how it didn't even necessarily need to happen, but it was such a flex and it was just like really impressive. And even though it didn't need to happen, it was kind of awesome anyway. I feel like the airport maybe isn't quite in the exact same category as didn't need to happen, because it, you know, I don't know that they could have resolved the movie before that point. So I guess it's sort of the same thing, but again, felt like such a flex. And I feel like it's not even necessarily like an iconic part of the movie, I don't think. Mm-hmm.
No, I forgot that's where it ended, legitimately. Could not remember what the climax of the movie was.
Right?
Which is weird to me. I don't know why I don't, because it's really good. It's really, like, it's weird how intense this movie is compared to the first one. Like, the fact that they're driving cars on the street and, like, causing car accidents and, like, at the airport. Like, there's so much happening in this movie. And, yeah, the whole sequence
is... They end on, like, an airport tarmac action sequence.
Wild. Wild. Like, if you were a person, that would be hard and intense. And they're toys. Like, like they're, like, a foot tall. Like, it's ridiculous.
Yep.
Yeah.
It's incredible. And also that, I mean, I love the sort of like fantastical whimsy that is the luggage sorting area. Gosh, yeah. Like, that is so ridiculous. It's very reminiscent of the door scenes from Monsters, Inc. You know, this just like chaotic mess of tracks, basically.
Mm-hmm. That was my first thought.
But it is. It's so funny because, like, yeah, if again, I think if you ask most people and said, like, how does that movie end? I think they would just say, like, oh, he doesn't go. Woody doesn't leave. But, yeah, it's wild.
Yeah. What I like, and kind of going back to, Derek, what you said at the beginning, all of the anxiety-producing stuff is all, like, really relatable. So, like, you know, airports in general are chaotic. And then when you go to, like, luggage and they roll through on the conveyor belt and you just see that open up, it's like, oh, my God. And, like, I get a certain feeling of anxiety and, like, tension in my chest because, like, I know how that feels, or I can imagine.
It's a lot. That the other thing that causes me anxiety is, like, car accidents. Yeah. And there's a lot of them in this movie.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, I don't think that was something that I ever felt, like, super anxious about until, like, recent rewatches of it, where I was like, oh, my gosh, they're just straight up causing accidents. Doesn't a telephone wire or a telephone pole, like, fall?
Yeah.
It was a light post. But, still, I mean, it's still terrifying. A big thing. I'm pretty sure somebody died in that car accident. Uh-huh. Like, those toys killed some people.
Right.
And it's just like, ah, ha, ha, those silly toys.
But I think what's funny is it, like, adds to the comedy because they're just, like, toys crossing the street completely oblivious. Mm-hmm. But good Lord.
Yeah. They're kind of, like, they cause more destruction and death than, like, the actual villains of the movie do. So.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yep. I love that traffic cone scene. Mm-hmm. It's so funny to me. Have you seen the Pixar in real life? Well, have you seen Pixar in real life at all, the series on Disney Plus?
No.
No.
So what they do is they take scenes or characters or situations from Pixar movies and they, in some way, shape, or form, apply it to real life, typically as, like, a hidden camera show. So for this one, what they did was they basically had remote control toys trying to, I think, maybe even cross the street or cross something. Probably not an actual street with traffic, but, like, do what these toys are doing, and people would like stop and be like, what in the world is happening? And they even had like, you know, speakers and stuff, so the toys were like talking and giving the exact same sort of Buzz Lightyear orders and stuff. And it cracked me up all over again just seeing people react to it. It's a really funny show. I mean, this is not about that, but I do think it's worth checking out if you like Pixar stuff. It's very cute to see how they try to like put Wall-E in the real world, or you know, have Merida be a real life character.
Oh, interesting. Okay. Yeah.
They don't all hit the same, obviously, but yeah, it's funny. And that's a scene that always stuck out to me, so it was funny to see it sort of brought into real life.
Yeah. I'm fascinated by the underplayed aspect of Woody being like an old legacy toy.
Yeah.
Because there's so many implications of that the movie is just like don't explore, which I think is fine because I think it would probably open up like way too big of a can of worms.
Mm-hmm.
But like there's enough subtle stuff where like he's referred like Andy's mom refers to him as like a family toy. Mm-hmm. And like if he's this old and he's this rare, like you can only assume that he probably was like Andy's dad's toy or something, right? Like I feel like that's got to be the assumption. At least that was kind of my takeaway from it, which if that's the case, and I know they never explore it, but if that's the case, like that opens up so many questions of like, what's it like to be a passed down toy? Like, does he remember Andy's dad at all? Or like, does your memories just like reset when you get a new kid? Like how, and I know we're not really supposed to question that,
sure,
but it is interesting for a series of movies that like does really good world building, but like sort of keeps certain questions at arm's length. It's fascinating that's one of the things they like suggest, but don't really delve into at all.
Well, one thing that's funny about that is if Woody is a legacy toy that has been passed down through multiple generations, I mean, have you all heard of the Jessie's human is Andy's mom theory?
No.
What?
No, but wait.
I mean, there's nothing. Okay, so it's worth noting that like this is not like an official Toy Story position or anything. It's just a thing that a lot of people have said like that could line up if you wanted it to. Like it could make sense. But if it does make sense, then Woody likely wouldn't have been Andy's mom's toy, or Derek, there is some sort of like weird memory magic that happens when they have a new owner or something. I mean, it's very much like not official. I'm even looking at certain things and like toys. I think the official position of Pixar is like, no, it's not. But, you know, if they're not actually going to define it, fans are going to fan, right?
Yeah.
But I do think it's a fun thing to explore. Like if he's a legacy toy, like, yeah, what does that mean? And Jessie now obviously is, but Jessie remembers her owner. So like, what do you do with all of that?
Right. And I do think it's sort of like, it's for the films and the entire series' benefit that they don't really dive into that, because then it's sort of like,
Totally. Well,
then why is Woody paranoid about like Andy stop playing with him? Because he would just assume that Andy would put him in a box until Andy has kids and then gets passed on to his kids. And there's no way that he would know whether like that he would think that Andy isn't going to have kids or anything, like, you know. So it's like it's like it opens up a can of worms that like it's better leaving that closed for the sake of the movie, because we need Woody to always be worried about what's going to happen next. Like that's the point. But it's just it's just interesting that they introduce Woody's age to this movie, like the implications that it creates. Like I'm glad that they do, because it opens up a really cool storyline that this movie has, but there are just implications to it that you have that are kind of unavoidable.
Yeah. And the more I think about it, the memory thing probably would be really hard to really build much on, based on, I'm just like thinking of other toys and various like human characters and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But I still do. And I've wondered, not specifically the way you're wondering it, but I have kind of wondered like if Woody is this old toy, right? From what, you know, basically he's Howdy Doody, right? Like that's what the show is supposed to be. How does Andy even end up with one of those, you know? Because it's such an unconventional toy for a kid to have, considering how old that show is, and how the status of that show is sort of like a collectible, right? It would be the equivalent of one of us watching Toy Story with a Howdy Doody doll. Like, that wasn't happening to me, you know?
Right.
So yeah, I've always kind of wondered that, but I've never really thought about much further than that. Now, she mentions that at the yard sale, right? She says it's a family toy.
Yeah, which, you know, it could, that could mean many things, but sure. I just assumed, oh, then like if he's that old, if he's like a 50-year-old toy or whatever, not 50-year-old, he's from the 50s.
Right.
Like if he's an old toy, then it would make sense if the reason he has such a connection to him is because his dad, who is either dead or has moved away and is not really in his life so much anymore, like if that's something memorable from his father. Like there's an instant emotional connection and it makes sense for why that became Andy's favorite toy from a young age, right? So like I think that helps explain it a little bit if you just assume that connection. But you know, they never say that outright.
Right,
so like
yeah,
who knows?
Totally. That's fun stuff to think about though. Because it's never really answered.
Yeah. Yeah. I do feel like the general moral of, or not moral, the lesson of the movie is so interesting in its complexity, because the idea being that just like it'll be fun while it lasts, like that, you know, everything ends and you can't worry about the ending. You just have to worry about like the good times that you'll have until you get to that ending, which is so, I didn't grasp that when I was a kid, because like what, why would that affect a kid at all? But it's so powerful as an adult because it applies to so many different things. Like the macro is that it applies to just like mortality and the fact that you're going to die. So, you know, enjoy life and find meaning in life until you die and not fret over it. But, you know, any type of like relationship that you enter into, like not being afraid of if the relationship is going to last for the rest of your life, as long as you have a good time until you reach like a natural endpoint, if you do, you know, I feel like that's a type of really complex, really poignant sort of life lesson that is not super common because it's not a comfortable one, that anything that you enjoy can end and to be like okay with that and be kind of zen about that. So the fact that that's the crux of this movie is so fascinating, you know, and I know that that becomes like the crux of the whole series, but the way that it's just sort of casually introduced is like, it's fine. Hey, you know what? You'll lose your owner. It's fine. It's fine. You'll be fine. Just have fun until it gets to that point. It's okay.
I think it's interesting you point out that that's part of this, because I feel like, yeah, it introduces that. And then the third movie like punctuates that heavily.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Because I was just thinking like, you know, that's also like the same lesson of like the movie Arrival. Like,
oh,
any
yeah.
type of, you know, like, which is like such a complex, like complicated, like really adult movie that ruminates on those things. And here it is in Toy Story 2, and it's pretty much the exact same lesson, you know?
Yeah.
Or any type of like romance story or something where it's like you fall in love with someone with a terminal illness or something like that. Like you see these things in stuff that is like not kid centric at all. And yet we are watching it as kids. And I think it is still an important lesson to see as a kid, even if you don't fully grasp it, because that's an important way to live life, you know?
Mm-hmm. You know what's kind of wild is, like, I don't know why I thought of this while you were describing it in those terms, but, like, there's also this sort of, I've never really thought of it this way, but there's sort of this whether to choose eternal life or not thing going on in this movie.
Yeah!
Yeah!
And I've never thought of Toy Story 2 being one of those stories, because it's not about vampires. It's not about magic. It's not about like ancient spells or anything. Like, it's about toys and collectibles and stuff like that. But that's kind of what they're addressing here, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, you could live eternally, but guess what? You'll also be empty. And no one will love you, and you'll watch everyone around you live their lives while you stagnate. Like,
God. Damn,
Toy Story.
I know.
Right.
And for a while, I think the thing, because like this, that definitely hit me harder than it did when I watched it the first time. And I like when Woody went along with that for a little bit, you know, like he was convinced.
Oh,
that
totally.
Was the way. And I get it to some degree, but then especially like when his friends came and he's like, "Nah, bro, like I'm good. Like I'm going to a museum. Mm-hmm. Like I'll be taking care of."
I do appreciate how they built up to that point though, right? Like I don't think it's, I mean, there's like a moment that is the catalyst for him actually changing his mind, mm-hmm. but they do such a good job from the very beginning of the movie building up to him changing his mind, mm-hmm. with being put on the shelf and what that meant, with other characters seeing and not fully understanding why he's at the yard sale in the first place, and sort of the sort of existential question there, the deep history of Woody's Roundup. And then, you know, Emily's story. Yeah. Like, they build up to the moment where he's like, oh my gosh, that's right. Like, there's so much here to build on to convince him that it doesn't totally come out of nowhere. And they don't rely, I mean, they do a little bit, but they don't rely too heavily on him getting a big head. It's not until he's confronted by the other toys that he starts to, like, manifest any of that stuff, you know?
Yeah. I'm on a yo-yo. I'm a yo-yo.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, my gosh. That's so funny. Was? But, yeah.
It's good.
And it's funny because, like, as a kid, like, I got a lesson out of it, but the lesson was, like, take care of your stuff and it's yours, and kind of the stuff we were talking about at the beginning of this episode, right? Like, right. So, oh, wow.
Yeah.
Deep.
Yeah. Yeah. What it's just such an interesting, interesting transition from the first movie to this movie.
Yeah.
And, you know, I love that the punctuation on at the end is that, like, once he gets back and Andy is just very casually like, oh, yeah, I didn't want to bring him to my camp because it would have ripped his arm off completely. And then he fixes him really easily. Like, the rip wasn't even a big deal. Like, an 11-year-old boy can just sew it up in no time. Like, it's
no big deal.
It's, yeah, it's like, oh, you're fretting over nothing because you should just enjoy what you have while you have it.
Gosh, yep. And isn't that, like, my entire life as an adult? Like,
right, right.
Relatable content.
Yep. Right. Ah, these movies are so good.
Right? Any other sort of, like, sundry bits, pieces, characters, scenes, sets, anything that, like, you want to shout out or just, like, praise or throw out there? Because there's a lot in this movie.
There is. I have such a long list, and most of them, like, don't matter.
Go for it. Throw things out
the
there.
Boner joke?
What?
There's a boner joke with Buzz.
There is a boner
end.
Joke. When Jesse
sees
the animal who needs help,
yeah.
Buzz's wings.
But they're wings.
I'm assuming that's the one you're talking
it's
about.
Not the same.
They pop out and then they repeat it in the bloopers.
Mm-hmm.
That's true.
Can't miss it.
Yep. That's definitely there. Also, the blooper where Mrs. Potato Head can't stop putting things in Mr. Potato Head's butt.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
Pay attention to his face next time you watch those bloopers. It's a lot.
Oh boy.
What else you got?
This is such a minor thing. And another, like, kind of interesting world building thing with the fact that Woody has a dream implies that toys can sleep and dream, which is really interesting.
That's the thing I forgot to mention when I was talking about the building up, right? Like, he has an anxiety dream about being thrown away.
Yeah,
that is a weird thing to think about, toys having dreams.
Yeah.
Yep.
One of the things from your Toy Story 1 episode that you talked about was, like, Woody kind of being a jerk and not being likable at times and kind of his arc there. How do you feel like he came through in this movie in comparison? Because for me, watching it in isolation, I felt positive about Woody. Like, I didn't remember Woody ever being as, like, annoying or jerk-like.
Sure.
So for me, he was good. But how does it feel for you all?
I think they utilize what they built from the first movie really well, in that the main conflict from the movie that exacerbated how much of a jerk he was no longer exists. Mm-hmm. So he's not as anxious. He's not as aggravated or irritated. He's not the villain of the movie, right? Mm-hmm. But you still end up seeing it at certain points because he is still, he has moments of being self-centered. He has moments of lacking consideration for other people, but it's not a huge part of his character because that specific combative anxiety isn't part of his character. So it manifests in a different way in his sort of, like, big-headedness over being a rare collectible. Mm-hmm. And you see that in the reaction from his friends, but they don't use it as much in this movie because I don't think they necessarily need to.
Yeah. I think a big part of it too is that the first movie, the source of his anxiety came from another toy specifically, so he had sort of like a scapegoat for all of his negative feelings. That drove him to do some really awful things. And and it's a lot more internal this time, like the reality of having his arm ripped. So like it's not directed at any one particular other person that he can inflict harm on. And also, you know, I think he does tend to be more open to his, like, he has a support system of other toys. Like, he's not keeping stuff as closed in as I think he did in the first movie, and like Buzz seems to really get him. Like the whole bit when they're trying to help him find his hat and stuff mm-hmm. like that at the beginning of the movie, like everybody is on better terms after the events of the first movie, mm-hmm. and that makes him a lot softer of a character. So like the worst that he does is more just kind of like being neglectful of like either people he's just met or not considering the effort that it took his friends to like try to come to rescue mm-hmm. him, right? Which still sucks, but like it's a little more understandable, and it's not him trying to literally murder someone like he did in the first movie. So it's definitely better. I liked him a lot more in this movie. Like I liked him in the first movie, understanding the terrible things he was doing, but like genuinely think he was mostly operating like on good terms in this movie.
Yeah. Woody's overall journey is a net positive.
Yeah.
You start to see it here.
Oh, the other thing that stuck out to me is that I complained about Randy Newman's songs in the first movie. Mm-hmm. I think that helped this movie, given that the only song you have or during the movie is the Sarah McLachlan song. And it's not just like scoring a thing that's literally happening right in mm-hmm. front of you. Like it's just portrayed in a much more artful way, right? As a flashback. So it fits better. And it's not just Randy Newman just singing what's happening. It's like an actual very like poetic song. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, the only other song you get is like the dance party ending that reprises You Got a Friend in Me. So like, I think it uses the Randy Newman music much more effectively by not using it too much like it did in the first movie. And it was a smart move. Mm-hmm.
There are two covers of the You've Got a Friend in Me, because they do the one at the end with, is it Robert Goulet? As the singing voice of Wheezy, if not the total mm-hmm. voice of Wheezy. And the I'm assuming it's Tom Hanks doing it. The Hanks Woody's Roundup version from the TV show.
Yeah, I forgot about that.
So it's in there, but yeah, not as heavy-handed. Mm-hmm. And they sort of tweak the way that they use the song in a much, much better way.
Yeah, I like it. Good. It's funny because I still feel like I like the first movie better overall just because of like its tightness and how simple it is. Mm-hmm. But that's very much like a subjective personal preference thing. This movie just has...
I mean...
It improves on so many like elemental things and narrative things and just like how everything looks. Like the lighting is amazing in this movie. The stuff that they do with lighting throughout it, mm-hmm. I was really impressed by too. And there's just so much to chew on in this movie.
Totally. Oh my gosh. The reflections on Buzz Lightyear's helmet in the opening scene. Mm-hmm. Like, good Lord. mm-hmm. So impressive. There's always like a laundry list, especially as we'll move forward, of like little... like Easter eggs and cameos and stuff. But in addition to the Bug's Life blooper, did you with the voices of Flick and Heimlich
and a mean little like, yeah, there's gonna be a Bug's Life too. It's like, nope, never. So you're rude. Never gonna see that.
So rude. did you catch the other Bug's Life appearance in the movie?
I saw the Brad Garrett Beetle as a toy in the background in the toy store.
Oh, well, there's many then. Oh. I didn't look up like a list or whatever. I should start looking at like a list each time we do these. But Andy has a calendar that's a Bug's Life calendar hanging on his wall in his room.
Cool.
Yeah, which is very cool. Did you catch other Easter eggs, Derek?
That's the only one that I spotted. But I imagine there's probably more than that in the toy store.
I'm sure. We didn't even talk about Easter eggs in the first two movies we did, I don't think. Sid's Toolbox is a Binford Toolbox, which is the company that Tim works for on Home Improvement.
Oh, cool.
Oh.
Binford Tools.
Interesting. Yeah. Okay.
So there's stuff everywhere.
That's fun.
Neat.
Either of you seen the short? I think it's a new short, the Toy Story Toys of Terror Halloween special on Disney Plus.
No, but I've heard good things about it, though.
So I watched it before we watched Toy Story 2, and it is like an identical plot line, kind of. So I won't go into detail since you didn't see it. And it is an enjoyable 21 minutes, but it's really interesting how similar it is in terms of like action and what the toys, what the situation the toys are put in, how it matches with this movie. So
interesting.
We've toyed with the idea of doing something shorts related, mm-hmm. but we haven't decided how or in what way. So maybe at some point that'll sort of come together and we'll chat about it. Even if just, you know, when we wrap up Toy Story stuff. I don't know.
Just one episode of just the Toy Story shorts, not even counting any other Pixar short.
For real.
I know there's tons of
them. Oh, really?
There's a lot of them, yeah.
And I've seen very few of them, if any.
Cool. Well, I think that's everything we've got for Toy Story 2. Thank you so much, Vicky, for joining us. It was so fun to have a guest.
Yes, thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Is there anything you want to plug or promote?
Sure. I would love to plug our other podcast, Novel Gaming.
Hey.
Novel Gaming is our bi-monthly kind of game and book club podcast. So it's a group of three of us. We've been friends for a very, very long time, and we love to chat about what games we're playing. We have a book club, so we pick a book about every other week or so, or every other episode or so, and just kind of chat about what's going on in our lives. And you can find it anywhere that you listen to podcasts.
Nice. Awesome. I highly recommend it, not just because I'm on it. If you want to find me and Derek, you can find us all over the place doing all kinds of things. Derek, where can people find you and the stuff you're doing?
Sure. You can find me on Twitter at Derek B. Gale. You can also find me on my YouTube series, Second Chance, which looks at bad or divisive media, but from a positive lens. What about you, Doug?
You can find me, as Vicky mentioned, on Novel Gaming. You can also find me, if you like Pokemon stuff, on a podcast called Victory Road, a Pokemon podcast, where my co-host Kyle and I talk about Pokemon just as we feel like it. You can also find both me and Derek together on a weekly podcast called Walloping Web Snappers, a Spider-Man podcast, where we deep dive into every single Spider-Man cartoon ever made. You can check out that anywhere you get your podcast, and you can see everything we are doing with Walloping Web Snappers on our website at wallopingwebsnappers.com or on our Patreon at patreon.com/wallopingwebsnappers.
And we would love it if you could rate, review, and subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, any podcast platform you want or you use, but especially if you use Apple Podcasts, please leave us a 5-star rating and a review. It really helps people find this podcast. And if you leave us a review, whether it's good or bad, we'll do a reading of it, a dramatic reading of it on our social media.
We've never mentioned that here, but we do that for Walloping Web Snappers, and we do it for anything we appear on.
Absolutely.
Awesome. Well, thanks everybody for listening. We will be back next month with another episode about, you probably can guess, the next movie in the Pixar canon, Monsters, Inc.
Oh, I didn't realize that was the next one after this. I'm excited.
See you then.
See ya.